My name's Willis, and unlike Greg, I am an alcoholic. Would you please join me in a moment of silence and gratitude for AA recoveries of the past 70 years? All right, let's have a meeting here. Our topic today is emotional sobriety, and that, in thinking over what that meant to me, I think what that means to me is recovery. That's what recovery looks like. And that's a very important topic to me because watching other people in the program demonstrate emotional sobriety is what saved my life when I got here, long before I caught alcoholism from you people. My sobriety date is October the 19th, 1984. Which is much more your doing than mine, I assure you. I live in Pocatello, Idaho, and my home group is the Chubbuck Sunday night group that meets in Chubbuck, Idaho. Now, Chubbuck is a suburb of Pocatello, and Pocatello is a suburb of a whole lot of sagebrush and potato fields. So they do have good AA there. And one of the things that we do, the first Sunday night of each month, we read the long form of the traditions. And if you haven't done that recently, I'd suggest that at some point you sit down and read through those. They're right here in the back of this big blue book here. This is a great book. It took me a long time to figure that out, but the long form of the traditions is right in there. And the long form of tradition number one has got a sentence in the middle of the paragraph that always grabs my attention. AA must continue to live or most of us will surely die. That's even simple enough for me to figure out. I got to tell you, having been around here yesterday and at that party last night and so far this morning, it looks to me like AA's got a few good years left, don't you think? One of my favorite parts of those 12 steps that I eventually had to work or drink, and again, it wasn't my fault when I got here, but I eventually had to work each and every one of those steps, and I love that part of the 12th step where it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I try real hard to remember that our goal here is to remain awake. You know, we're all going to take those little naps here and there, but we're trying to get over that Rip Van Winkle stuff. And part of our goal this morning, we've got three speakers that are going to play Reveille for us and try to get us awake again and back where we belong, you know, passing this word along. So please join me in welcoming from Toronto, Ontario, Deborah R.
Good morning. I'm Deborah, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a member of the Rocks Glen Traditional Group. Some of you were there last night. We were at capacity last night here in Toronto. And my sobriety date is November 1st, 1994. I just wanted to take a minute to welcome you to what I think is one of the world's best cities. And Toronto is very happy to have you here. And I hope that you have a great time over the next few days in this city and here with us in Toronto. I'm glad you're here. This morning, prior to coming to this meeting, I have a couple of out-of-town visitors staying at my house, and we had a 10-step meeting on my deck. And because I needed to get ready for this, and really, I need your wisdom. And so this morning, it's really Mary Lynn C. and Gail M. who have helped to prepare me to be here. But it's also your wisdom that has, you know, brought me here. And I think that emotional sobriety was really one of the things that drove me to AA, that the kind of drama, turbulence, shame, anger, that whole mix of emotions was the thing. He wants me to speak. They want me to speak up. The whole, yeah? Okay. Turn it up. Okay. Will you give me the thumbs up when you can hear me? Yeah, you got it. Okay. It was all of those, that kind of emotional non-sobriety when I was practicing that brought me to the program. And all of the drama that was a part of my life that was integral to the drinking, you know, clung to the drinking, all of the anger, shame, hostility, resentment, all of those things that kept me in the bar a little too long. And so I think when I thought of emotional sobriety, and I can sometimes fall into this same kind of delusion that it was something that I would get one day, all of my ducks would be lined up in a row, all of the turbulence would be at bay, I would be free of anger and resentment, and a great peace would descend upon me, and that would be emotional sobriety. Has that happened for anyone here? In fact, we have somebody here who is... I would like to say that I have moments. And actually, you know, in our discussion this morning, I think that we agreed that emotional sobriety was having a life that could have many things, you know, emotional turbulence, but remaining okay in the midst of it. And that really, for me, is what emotional sobriety is. I wanted to, you know, talk about my life recently. About a year and a half ago, I moved to Toronto only 4 years ago, and I moved from a very beautiful community in Ontario called Stratford. I know that there are some of you out there. I see some beautiful faces from Stratford out there. And in Stratford, I had spent 12 years living a very, I had a very terrific working life. But I felt like I needed to grow a bit more and to change, so I made a big move. And from that point on, my working life became a very turbulent place and lacking the sort of peace that it had had for about 12 years. And over the course of the last 4 years, I have been fired for the first time from a job. I have faced more rejection than I ever thought humanly possible to face. But in the midst of it all over the last 4 years, there was some part of me that knew that no matter what, that God was driving the bus and that it was going to be okay. And that oftentimes it was going to be even better than okay. Because I think a lot of times my own vision about where I should be or what I should be doing is quite limited. And that God often wants for me far more than I want for myself. So I think it's that sense of knowing that God is always with me that has contributed a great deal to emotional sobriety. And emotional sobriety, I understand, is possible even, you know, when you're getting fired. Or when you're, you have to do some work. I'm not saying that. I wasn't selling out of that door. But, you know, the other thing that I think is really important to remember, again, is the thing that I began with, is that it's through other people and through this program. So it's not only the woman who sat with me on my deck this morning and had that 10-step meeting. It's also all of the people who have walked the path with me. And sponsorship is a great part of 10th step or of all our step work. And I am happy to report that I have... Can you hear? And I am happy to report that I have the best of sponsorship in this program. And so when I am feeling emotionally off balance, you know, as well as turning to God, I find it so helpful to turn to my sponsor and other people in the program who can provide me with the kind of wisdom that I lack at any particular moment. And, you know, I know the two things in the 10th step, which really, this step for me is the step that deals with the present moment. You know, the 4th and the 5th deal with the past. The 10th step helps me to deal with all the things that are in the present. But the two things that stand out for me in that particular step are the spiritual axiom, which I can find quite annoying at times. Because it's a bit funner sometimes and a bit easier to think that you are the problem and not me. But eventually, you often lovingly get me to the point where I see that it's me that needs to do some work. And the other part of the 10th step is thy will, not mine, be done. And so I think just having those two, bearing in mind those two pieces of that that step are, you know, so important. I think I've just drawn a blank, but I have to go on for... I do. Ten more minutes. Okay. Can you start praying for me? You know, one of the other things that we were talking about this morning is sometimes when I have worked through the steps, and I continue to work through the steps regularly, you get to the 10th step, and I know some of you have those sheets where you tick off, you know, the faults and, you know, where you've done well. And I don't do that sort of physical thing every night where I'm sitting down and taking that inventory. But I guess the benefit of being around here for a while is that you do understand almost immediately when I have done something wrong, or I get a feeling of discomfort, physical discomfort, that is a clear indication that I have some work to do. And there have been times along the way where I get that sheet out and I'm just put myself into that state of reminding myself of where I need to get back on track, as well as where I am on track. Because I know that there certainly have been times in my sobriety where I felt as if it was all one way. I was all bad. And that's just another form of egotism. To think that everything is wrong and there's nothing that is right. So when I have that feeling of discomfort, generally I, you know, seek God's help. I am very good about getting right on the phone to my sponsor, who always has some advice that is very helpful to me. And, you know, just the idea that somebody else out there knows, and then even more importantly, that somebody else out there might be praying for me, is such a great comfort and relief. I don't have to carry these kind of dramas around with me by myself anymore. And I think that is one of the most beautiful things, you know, about being a part of the community. And I think that thing about not being all one way or all the other, all good or all bad, recognizing that I like to say that I am beautifully imperfect. And I think that we all are beautifully imperfect. And, you know, I have many friends in this program all along the path, people who have many, many more years sobriety, people with much younger sobriety, and I know that the work of emotional sobriety continues all along the path. So it's not the destination, it's the journey. And emotional sobriety is progressive. It's not something that I'm going to get to or arrive to. And so I'm very that is very helpful information, because I think I can even get into this at times where I believe that I have to be perfect, emotionally perfect, and I chastise myself when I fall short or I fail. And, you know, I have to remember that it is progress, not perfection. you know, in my life right now, I was telling one of the women who is staying with me that I have this very, I met with someone yesterday and something came up, and it's a really small thing that came up, but oftentimes I have a choice when it comes to emotional sobriety, whether I give a situation energy or whether I choose another way. And, you know, sometimes when I mean I can make it more dramatic, I can feed into whatever is going on, or I can choose the way of finding another way. And I think that that's really important. And sometimes it is ever so subtle in my life. And that, you know, in part of the step 10, it talks about motives. And oftentimes, like, I don't really get to thinking about my motives. Sometimes I do, but it's not something that I think of a lot. And maybe I should think about it more. But there are situations that come up where I have to investigate my motives. Suddenly, am I louder? Suddenly? Yeah, the higher power. It's probably Ontario power. At any rate, examining my motives is a really important thing for me to do. It's examining. Now I've got nothing. Hello, there we go. So just getting back to, I'll let Willis fix this. Now we're in trouble, he says. Okay, I won't touch anything. So examining my motives is a really good thing. And I, you know, ultimately, it's a God deal. The whole thing is a God deal. And thy will not mine be done is, I, you know, it's a mantra. And it's certainly the thing that has allowed me to, you know, have 10.5 years of this great life in sobriety. And I think that's enough for me on emotional sobriety today. I hope that you have a great conference. And now I'll look forward to sitting with you.
Thank you, Deborah. And looking at the wiring job on this mic, I'm glad to know that Idaho is not the only place that uses duct tape for everything. Please join me in welcoming our next speaker from San Francisco, Bill R.
Good morning. My name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay. God help us all. My sobriety date is September 10th, 1989, and I was 24 years old, and I was going on 100, and I bumped into someone, one of my compadres at that time in the hospitality suite yesterday, and he turned to my friends and said, oh, he was so old. And so I'm getting younger. Okay. I don't. Emotional sobriety to me has only come through time. Time and some understanding. Time and some right action. And I'm awed to speak here. And I thank the servants that be who got me up here. I'm going to do the standard kind of pitch in some way. I was born in an Irish Catholic parochial family in New York City. And we were the family on the block that everybody looked at. There was a lot of mental illness and a lot of alcoholism and a lot of violence and a lot of shame. And that's when I came to AA, the only things I really had was a high level of anxiety, a mountain of shame, and a facade of grandeur. And, you know, slowly but surely over the last 15 plus years, you know, that's peeled away. And I've had opportunities provided to me because I have shown up every day as a sober member of AA. I arrived in AA so humiliated and ashamed that I had to walk through those doors. And my first meeting was at the Carlyle Group in New York City on East 62nd Street. And I walked around the block probably a dozen times, terrified that someone might see me going into the doors of a church. It wasn't a Sunday. And I arrived in the right room at the right time where I was supposed to show up. And I sat in the back row, and I got there, and really all I wanted was a meeting book. You know, I knew a little bit about you all, and I just wanted a meeting book to understand, to see, to read, to touch, to feel. And they didn't have any. So this paranoid 24-year-old going on 100 sat there thinking, they don't put them out till the end. It's really what I thought, you know. And at the end of the meeting, I expected them to come out. They had other literature there, but I was not interested. And at the end of the meeting, I waited for that meeting book to arrive. And of course, you know, it didn't. And this one guy, I can still see him, David G., tilted his head out of a conversation across a crowd and looked at me. And it was like, you know, tunnel vision. Oh, no, they found me. And he said, are you new? And I said, and I said, no, I'm just looking for a meeting book. At which point the reverberation started. 12 people were surrounding me, digging in purses and briefcases and all these things, trying to find a meeting book for this, for me, the one who really didn't matter. You know? And Judy S. gave me her meeting book with all of her numbers on it. And she said to me, this is the only one I have. You have to bring it back on Monday. And, you know, 4 invitations to coffee later. Oh, no, I couldn't. I simply couldn't. I had too much to do. I had to get the laundry out from under my bed that had been there for a while. And I went to coffee. And the ladies and gentlemen of that meeting saved my life. I didn't have anyone to talk to that I felt I could tell any truth to. I didn't know what the truth was. I did know I couldn't stop drinking. I did know I had started to have blackouts. I did know I was starting to wake up with people that I not remember what happened. And in 1989, that wasn't a healthy thing. So time progressed, and I got a commitment, and they made me a coffee maker. I like my coffee strong. And at that time, so did you. I think a moment of emotional sobriety might be that now I accept you might not. So time passes, you know, I got made secretary, blah, 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 speak, whatever. I came to my first anniversary in sobriety, and I was still that ashamed boy. To the point where at this particular meeting, you generally asked your sponsor to hold the cake while you blow out the candle. And I didn't have enough self-esteem to ask my sponsor to do that for me. So when it was my turn, the cake person did it because he just kind of went, okay. You know. And when I think of that, that's kind of how I lived my life. Surmising the situation and going, okay, you know. I don't walk into my house anymore. I live alone. And go, what's going on? Who do I need to be right now? I don't live that way anymore. I think that's some emotional sobriety. So time passed, and I lost my job for the first time in sobriety. I was a workaholic. Oh, was, right? Did I? Anyway, I lost my job for the first time in sobriety. I had worked since I was 10 years old. I was 25. I had worked my way up in an organization that I got pushed out of. And I was really lost then. And it was probably the greatest thing that ever happened, because I got involved in the program, and the people in the program put their arms around me and helped push me through. You know, Eugene O, who's here, used to just tell me where to be, and that's where I'd be. So I took some time and just followed. You know, I had had to be a leader of some sort in my family, and for a little while I just followed. And I said to a newcomer I was talking with last night, who was, you know, has, I don't know, 30-some-odd days of sobriety, and I've watched him for a little period of time, and we started to have that discussion, well, is AA a cult? And I said, you know what? I turned to him and I said, you know, we can have this conversation on your second anniversary. If you're out there, Bryson, I love you. The important message of that is that first things first. I can't solve big problems until I take care of my daily maintenance. And I didn't know how to do that when I got here. I wasn't efficient at many things, except being at the bar at the right time, figuring out how many cocktails I had to buy before someone would buy me one, figuring a way to visit your summer share. Making sure I was friends with the right people. You know, that's what I was good at. Time passed, you know, and a series of circumstances happened that opened the door for me to have to look at moving to California. And I truly believe in my heart that that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. And I had the opportunity to go to California after 18 months of unemployment, and I had a full-time job within 3 weeks, and a roommate situation within a month, and it all progressed from there. And when I say it progressed, I worked my way up in another organization, I moved to another company, and had until June 3rd of this month, of this year, a 10-year career in sales and marketing in the healthcare environment. I never could have sold anything without being in AA. I could, you know, I've gained integrity and credibility since I've been here. I was honest on my expense reports. You know, so that's kind of how I landed here. But I want to talk a little bit about learning how to not necessarily be reactive, because I think emotional sobriety is about learning some of those trigger points in your life that send you over the edge. And we all have people, places, and things that can do that. And the best exercise I've ever learned around that was when that situation starts to occur, I step back, I take a deep breath, and before I say a word, I say, God, I'm pissed. You know? And then I march on, hopefully with a little inspiration from my higher power. You know, I've been around over 15 years, and I have a few opinions. I know that's rare. But I believe you have to keep growing. I believe you have to keep opening your heart and opening your door and answering your phone and showing up at meetings. Service work is at every level,
whether you're doing the coffee, whether you're sitting in your chair, whether you're a GSR or DCM delegate, intergroup, or whatever. And service work has helped keep me sober and has made me learn tremendous things about myself. I was on the intergroup committee in San Francisco for a few years, and I really had to learn how to appreciate that, wow, they don't know anything I'm talking about. And I had to learn what they were talking about, a different experience, a different understanding. Not everyone starts at the same point. And it's not always a straight line. See the flag. Anyway. That's you know, I had the pleasure to move to California. I was in Laguna Beach, California for 5 years, and I got a tremendous boost to my sobriety being in Southern California. New York sobriety gave me a tremendous foundation in the basics, 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, use the phone, you know, stick with the winners, first things first, live and let live. As I have grown up in sobriety, I have learned more and more of what each of those things mean. So I'm in Laguna Beach, and I'm successful to the point of I'm employed, I have a place to live, I have a car to drive, and I had a couple of years where I just got really quiet. My committee retired for a while. And I think that saved my life. You know, I allowed that quietness to happen. And from that, a voice came. You know, from that, I found out who Bill was. I found out what Bill could do. I found out what makes Bill uncomfortable. And in some of those cases, do it anyway. And in other of those cases, respect it. That's emotional sobriety. I've had the pleasure of meeting, you know, incredible people, some crazier than batshit. And others who need a little craziness, you know? And saying that, I believe in living in the middle of the lifeboat, you know? I believe in being in all rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in showing up. I believe in putting your hand out. I could never give back what I've been given. When I get in a tight spot, I can sit wherever, and in my head, I go to that meeting that saved my life. And in those rows were particular people who were there every single time that meeting met. Some of them I never talked to, but they were there showing up. I can show up through anything today. Anything. I know that. I have that faith. And for that reason, you know, I'm taking some leaps of faith right now. I've just left a career. I'm going back to graduate school. I'm planning a new endeavor. I turned 40 in April, so I figured if I'm ever going to do it, I better hurry up. And I could never do any of this if I wasn't sober. You know? Never. How am I doing? I have a few more minutes? Okay. So, let's talk about how you face your fear, because I think that's emotional sobriety. You know? And being afraid to be who you are, being afraid to tell someone you hate them or you love them in one form or another. You know what? I'm really not comfortable with you. Give me a little space. That's okay, because it's taking care of me. You know? I'm too comfortable with you. Right? What's going on? You know, that's addressing the moment. So I'm not living in, well, you know, we could and we will and we're gonna, or I shoulda, coulda, woulda, did-a. You know, it's living in the moment and having the strength and the faith that I'm gonna be okay no matter what happens, as long as I don't drink or use. My sponsor is an incredibly loving man. And, you know, I don't know if you know this yet, but from my background, I can be a little cynical and sarcastic. and I know I'm not unique. And I've had to really look at why am I so cynical and sarcastic, and what do I want to do about it? Because loving actions rarely start in cynicism. I have had to stop and keep my mouth shut. I talked a little bit about taking the right action, and sometimes that is sitting still. What's that? I heard that. I don't have to fix anyone. I don't have to fix anything. I need to do the next indicated step. If I get too big in my mind on fixing or doing the big stuff and not focused on the little stuff, I've lost. It's through the increments of the little stuff that I gain. And whether that means meeting those 90 meetings in 90 days, or it means keeping your AA commitments, or your family commitments, or your business commitments, whether it means showing up and doing a decent day's work for a day's wage, whether it means you have to be a friend to get a friend, you have to be a worker to get a worker. You know, there's a commonality and a connection that I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've taken to my life. And that has made my life so much richer, so much fuller. And I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for that. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much, Bill. Our next speaker is from Manhattan, New York. Please join me in welcoming Lorna Kay.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Lorna Kelly, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm awfully reluctant to tell you my sobriety date, because I think people will think, good God, she's that long sober and she's still acting like that. So I want to thank Deborah and Bill for speaking, and I want to thank the committee for asking me to speak. And when they first approached me, they asked me to speak on laughter in sobriety. And I said, you know, I'm British and we are not amused. And so and then they sort of tossed out emotional sobriety, and my friends went, what? But anyway, here I am, and I'm the least person really, really, really to be talking about this. I can't imagine. But I was just at a wonderful meeting downstairs, actually, right underneath us of the corrections and facilities meeting, and there was a fellow there who was a long time sober, and he said this wonderful line. He said, the message I carry is the message I need to hear. So, you know, when I first used to speak, I used to think and I used to say, I hope there's something I can say that's helpful to you. I hope that you get something out of what I have to say. And now I realize I'm not here to help you at all. You know, I'm here because God thinks that one needs a lot of help. So I get to share and to talk to you. And I want to sort of go on the other side of the coin a bit, you know, about emotional sobriety. I'm fascinated with the life of Christ. And I know you can mention Jesus in an AA meeting and clear the room. But I just find him very intriguing. You know, he was someone that really put his money where his mouth was, and he went for it, and, you know, he kept his eyes on his prize, and he didn't listen to the whinings of all those people, and he just went for it. I mean, he ended up dreadful, but still, he did what he wanted to do. But, and, you know, there's a story in the Bible that we can sort of believe it, I suppose, that Jesus at one time was in the temple and really acted out. He took this whip and was getting the money changers out and opening the cages and releasing the... Can you imagine the mayhem that was there? Coins rolling all over the place and animals squawking and bleating and the mess. Now, I don't read in the following chapters that he went back the next day and said, I'm awfully sorry. You know, and... do you know, I was having a bad disciple day or something. You know? So, I don't know whether it's always so terrific to be cool, calm, and collected. And, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. As Deborah was saying, you know, there is this thing. There's no way that I can reach and I feel, aha, that's it. I've reached this point. You know, I always say I have a deep, abiding faith that comes and goes. And, and so it is with emotional sobriety. You are looking at a witness to a saint. I was called as a witness for Mother Teresa's canonization. I'm a witness. And, you know, if you want to know the process for when it's my turn, just... you know, here I am. I have all these lofty things in my portfolio of spirituality, and yet I can't be decent to the checkout person, you know, So I don't know. I really don't know much of anything. And I'm stalling for time because I think I'd rather be talking about 19th century paintings or something, you know. But I think the speakers before have certainly given a lot of wisdom about emotional sobriety. And let me just throw out a few things. I think one of the greatest things to learn... And one of the things I tell people that are new in the program to keep in mind and to have it tattooed on you, this phrase, I've changed my mind. I think this is such an important phrase. I have changed my mind. And, you know, I can change my mind about all sorts of things. I can just basically, I can... be in a bar, I can have my hand around a drink, I can have it up to my mouth, and I've changed my mind. I can, you know, and this thing we say, I'm the sort of person that does this. Well, I can change my mind. I'm not that sort of person. I'm not the sort of person that gets angry. I'm not the sort of person that always sits in that particular seat. I'm not that that person. And it's a very dangerous thing for me because that goes over into I'm the sort of alcoholic. I'm the sort of alcoholic who does blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's all right for me to keep alcohol in the house because I'm the sort of alcoholic that never drinks at home. Well, you know, anything that any alcoholic has ever done under the influence of alcohol, if I have alcoholism, I'm capable of doing it. So I can't say, oh, I would never do that or I'd never do this. And I'm not a sort of alcoholic. I have alcoholism and I'm an alcoholic. And I have absolutely no idea where this is going. And, I figure the accent will carry me a lot. Get away with murder. So now what else can I talk about? I think this thing of changing one's mind and being able to have the humility and the ability to be flexible shows great emotional sobriety. And for those of you that are in the room that say, oh, well, you know, I'm in this particular situation and I'm in that particular situation, it's very difficult for me. I would like you to top this. I am an auctioneer. And in early sobriety, I was asked to do a benefit auction at the Plaza Hotel in New York. And I arrived at this auction, you know, done up like a dog's dinner in a gown, and that, and it was a $1,000 a plate dinner. And it was held in the Grand Ballroom at the Plaza Hotel. And I start auctioning, and they will not keep quiet. I could not control that room. I could not get them to pay attention to me. And I realized I can only do this with a little vodka and orange juice in my stomach. I need that lining of courage to get me through this ordeal. And suddenly, you know, all your faces went before me, and I knew it wasn't worth it. And I turned the mic up very loudly, and I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I can no longer afford to be here." And I stormed out of the Plaza Hotel, out of the group, picked up my shawl, and walked out of the Plaza Hotel. And, you know, and I want you to know, amazing though it may seem, those 400 people are not still sitting there waiting for me. And, you know, life goes on. And being able at that point, you know, there are some points in our lives, and every one of us is called to this in sobriety, where we are the sensing rod of AA. We are the sensing rod of life. We are out there, and it's vibrating. Which way is it going to go? Is it going to go this way? And there are, heaven holds its breath, as it did when Bill Wilson stood in that lobby in Akron, Ohio. You know, was he going to go towards the bar, or was he going to go towards the telephone directory? And heaven held its breath. And you and I are here because that man made a decision. And that decision was not made because he... I often think, you know, what would have happened if Bill Wilson had had a successful day? Would we... you know... I doubt that we would be here. And I think looking, I have long-term sobriety, and I think looking for it to be a certain way, or there's this notion in AA, and you know, I'm long enough sober that I don't mind causing a little controversy. There's this notion in AA that life is supposed to be peaceful and wonderful and happy. Who said? I mean... And if I'm on a spiritual path, and there's no one spiritual person that I've admired in life that's had it comfortable. It's not, spiritual life is not necessarily comfortable. And when we're on that sensing rod and we get to choose, it's not a comfortable choice always. It's painful, it's awkward. It's, and usually that's one of the characteristics of it. It's awkward. It makes us feel awkward. And I have two more stories. And one of them is, you know, a lot of you know I was very friendly. Well, like I just told you, I was called as a witness for Mother Teresa. And one of the times she was dreadfully ill, and I went dashing off to Calcutta to be with her. And Mother was fascinated with AA. Fascinated. And I always think to myself, you know, anyone that's fascinated with AA, they've probably got a problem. And, you know... Because I always say, you know, if you want to come to meetings and you like coming here and you like listening to stories about how people, you know, threw up on their bosses and were crawling on the bathroom floor and were contemplating suicide or murder and you find it interesting, there's something the matter with you. So, but Mother was intrigued with AA, absolutely intrigued. And one of the reasons she was intrigued was because she had success with every form of suffering human that she could not help. The alcoholic. And she could not help the alcoholic because she didn't have the words of everlasting life that you and I have. She did not know how to say, "I know how you feel. Let me tell you what happened to me." Anyway, I went off to Calcutta and... And Mother was in bed in the hospital, and I go into this very tiny room, and which is mostly the bed is taking up the room. And while I was there, this young Indian priest came in, and he was going to say Mass. And you know that table that they bring up for the patients that the patient eats off? Well, that was at the foot of the bed, and he set it up as the altar, and he's facing Mother, and he's saying Mass. And it's not lost on me that this is a pretty important moment. I mean, here's Mother Teresa, Lorna Kelly, you know, I mean, not bad. So, he's saying Mass, and I'm trying to be very devotional, and then he comes around, he gives the offering communion, and as he offers communion to Mother, he dips the host in the chalice of wine and offers this dripping wafer to Mother, who takes it on her tongue. I'm next. The host is in the chalice. And, you know, there's that thought that runs through the mind. Oh, my God, not here. Don't let me have to make a fuss here. Not with this saint dying in bed next to me. You know, please, 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 don't let me have to bring all the attention onto myself. Let me just pass it by. It's the blood of Jesus. It's not, you know... It's not wine, just, it's sacramental, and it doesn't matter. Just take it, take it, take it. And then, you know, there's that point of being the sensing rod. There's that thing of heaven holding its breath. There's thousands that have gone before me, and millions, hopefully, millions that will come after me. But they will not come if I am not true. God has not called me to be successful. God has called me to be faithful. And how faithful can I be? How faithful in this awkward, embarrassing moment can I be? Can I stand out there and be awkward? And I said to him, no, I don't want it. Please, and he handed it to the other sister standing next to me. And then I said, but I would like the communion, please. And he finally gave me the wafer and walked around the other side of the bed. And I'm shaken. I'm really shaken, you know. And Mother's hand came across the cover, and she grabbed my hand, and she said, she whispered to me, well done. You must continue to protect your precious gift. So you and I have a very, very precious gift, you know, and I think for emotional sobriety, I only get it if I'm with you. I only get to feel that or know what it looks like if I'm with you. And I would like to end with this story, which is one of the most frightening stories. I saw it on a nature program. a little while ago. And it's so, many of you might have seen it. It was a program about the Amazon forest. And in the Amazon, there's this mighty, mighty tree called the Brazilian nut tree. And it's this huge, huge thing with a great canopy on it. And 35,000 species of creatures live in this tree, from microscopic things to great big birds nesting and all that. So, a bird lands on the branch, and the bird goes to the bathroom on the branch, drops on the branch. In the bird's dropping is a tiny seed. The seed sprouts, and the seed sends out a shoot that drops hundreds and hundreds of feet into the forest floor. And the seed plants itself, the shoot plants itself in the forest floor, and then grows up. And it grows as a vine, and it wraps itself around the host tree. And it wraps itself, and this takes years. And as it wraps, it becomes thick like the tree. And have you ever seen, you know, I'm sure you've seen wrought iron fences where the tree has grown around the wrought iron fence, where it's like that. So this great vine grows around this mighty, mighty tree. And it crushes the tree. Crushes it. And finally, the camera took us to the top of the tree. And you've got to look down these hundreds of feet into this huge sort of tube of nothing. The tree was gone. absolutely gone if it had been crushed and destroyed by this thing that was so slow. And, you know, it frightened me to death. I realized I need to go to meetings. I need to be around you so that you can say, Lorna, do you know you have a little shit on your arm? And it's this thing that seems so imperceptible, so nothing, so ordinary, my personality, or that's the way I am, a habit in tardiness, or whatever it is I'm calling it, that seems so darling at the time. And really, it's the thing that kills. And, you know, how often have we heard, oh, Bill or Harry or Susan or Meg, they were 20 years sober, and God, they went out and drank again, and can you imagine? Isn't that amazing? And so I certainly don't take this for granted. I certainly understand, you know, that I probably have a lot of droppings on me that I need help, because I, like the tree couldn't get it off itself. I need you to point it out to me and show me, how do I get that stuff? How do I remove that stuff? It's nothing I can just do like this. It takes a concentration and a desire. And so I want to thank you very much for going to meetings. I want to thank you for doing service. I want to thank you for putting money in the basket and for doing all that you do, because if you weren't here, I'd have nowhere to go. Thank you for your sobriety.
This is a tough crowd, Lorna. You mentioned Jesus, and we're still in trouble with the fire marshal. Because they're the only two things I know for sure, I want to say one more time. My name's Willis. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a doctor and a lawyer. Now, is that a golden opportunity to be an asshole or what? And I tell you that just so I can tell you this. That is the only reason I got to AA. Those people at my intervention that were prying into my business and well-intentioned but had the wrong guy. One of the guys there had some good connections with the State Board of Medicine, and when he threatened to turn me in as an impaired physician, I couldn't sign into treatment quick enough. Okay, I didn't believe one minute that I had a problem. You know, if these people had my responsibilities and you know, my worries and concerns, they'd drink like I did. And if they'd just leave me alone a little bit longer, I'd get it figured out. Okay. Well, as you might imagine, my 30-day stay in treatment was not exactly a Caribbean cruise. I sat there and would listen to these other people talk. Yeah. And I came out of there at the end of my program. I graduated with a degree in fear. I was afraid. They did convince me of one thing. If I drank again, there was a good chance I was going to end up back in treatment. So for me, AA was the next to last place on earth I wanted to be. And so I begrudgingly went to AA with the lovely attitude of, I will attend, but I will not participate. And I sat back in the corner, you know, all overeducated and unmotivated, and my case is different. But I learned all the program slogans, you know, at the treatment center. And at about 3 or 4 months sober, I finally worked my way up to the table, and at one noon meeting, there was this guy who was having a terrible time and pouring his life out and crying, and I don't know what all was wrong. And it came my turn to talk, and I put together what I thought for him was a very well-organized, thoughtful, the soliloquy that I delivered to help him solve his present and as well as his future problems. And sitting directly across the table from me is a little 30-year-old lady, a retired nurse that had been sober about 30 years. And when I finished talking, she looked across the table and very lovingly pointed out to me, in front of everybody else, how full of crap I was. And I was mortified. You know, here I was trying to help this poor guy along, and she had taken issue with what I said. And so for my first year and a half, I hung around the fringe of this program, and I'll tell you, no alcohol and no recovery, that's a bad combination for if you're an alcoholic. I hit bottom at a year and a half sober. I was standing in front of the mirror one day, and I finally had run out of people to blame and circumstances to blame my life on. I think about the phrase in the Big Book where it talks about we absolutely insist on enjoying life, says we are not a glum lot. And I love that word glum because when I think about my image reflecting back on me in the mirror, that's what I felt, glum. You know, I had hit pitiful and incomprehensible immoralization when I was sober. That's bad. Well, Elsie's the one I called, you know. She loved me enough to tell me the truth. So I said, what do I do? And her response was, have you thought about working the steps? And so I did. You know, I started back at a year and a half since my last drink. I started through the steps. She got me started and pointed me toward getting another sponsor. And that's when I met Reverend Ron. Ronnie B. Was a guy that had a sixth grade education. He didn't care who I was or what I did for a living. And to this day is the only man I have ever met who looked perfectly well-dressed in blue alligator shoes. One of the things that attracted me to him is, you know, he had made and lost several fortunes in drunkenness and in sobriety, but he was very, very comfortable telling about these mistakes he had made and about his past. He was okay with that. He was okay with who he was. So I got started working with Ron, and you know, I had been sitting around these tables listening to people whine and complain about their problems, my mind did start to wander before they got to the part about the program was working for them, they were staying sober, and they were going to come back for another day. So it still didn't make a bit of sense to me. And so I had a real crisis come up. I took to Ron, things were getting bad for me. I just, one of this orthopedist that I worked with at the hospital was getting ready to buy a Ferrari. And, you know, it occurred to me, here I was busting my ass all hours of the day and night, you know, diagnosing these fractures and putting them in splints and sending them to his clinic at normal office hours and putting these poor little ladies with broken hips in the hospital for him to operate on at his convenience. And as we all know, orthopedists are just carpenters that use sterile technique. And so... Here was this orthopedist that was getting ready to buy a Ferrari, and, you know, I went to Ron, and my heart was on my sleeve, you know. Here I am, I'm trying to change my life, I'm giving up all these things, and here this bastard's buying a Ferrari. Well, Ron listened to this crap for a while, and decided we were going to go for a ride, and sixth grade education or not, he was way too smart to tell me where we were going. He took me down to downtown Houston to the 24-hour club, where there were guys, you know, from Skid Row that were sobering up for the gazillionth time, and got me a nice fresh cup of coffee and parked me on the couch between two of these guys and said, here, see what you can do to help these guys. And we were there for several hours, and I kept thinking, oh, my God, they're going to throw up on me. You know. And I'll tell you, when we got back to Ron's house, we pulled in the driveway, and my little Nissan looked the best it had since I'd driven it off the showroom floor. Okay, I took it home and washed it and waxed it, and to this day, I've never owned a Ferrari. Now, tomorrow I may be real crazy about that, but for the last 20 years, I've been okay, so I think I'm pretty much over the worst of it. But he took me through the steps, and as he did, it occurred to me that the only thing that I had going for me when I got here was a lot of denial. You know, I was the only one that couldn't see. And as we worked the steps, I had this IMAX projector that allowed me to start looking back on my drinking life. And all of a sudden, you know, I began to realize all the times I was working 24-hour shifts, and I would take care of these victims of drunk drivers all night, these people had been shot and stabbed, and I could rant and rave about all the evils of alcohol and comfort these bereaved family members, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, I would make a beeline from the hospital parking lot to the liquor store to get two quarts of beer for my drive home, and in 15 minutes, those two quarts would be gone. And never once did it occur to me what I was doing. You know, my case was different. that went on and on and on, and I was finally given the ability to look back on what I had thought of as a respectable life, and it scared me to death. What I did find out was that regardless of how you eventually get there, this program does work. And it was, I don't know about for the rest of you, it was so comforting for me to finally have a diagnosis. You know, there was finally a name attached to all that crazy thinking I had. You know, I had these crazy thoughts that I felt compelled to act on, and I had no reason why. And all of a sudden, when I came to grips with my disease, you know, there was a reason for that. And once there was a reason for that, the thoughts may come and go, but I was given the choice whether or not to act on them. And the longer I hung around here and the more I listened to you, you know, the thought process started to change a little bit. And it started to work. And what I was doing this whole time, from the beginning, sitting back in the corner as I was watching, you know, I wasn't going to participate. I sat back there. This doesn't apply to me. But I watched. I watched you people and saw how you did it. I didn't believe a word you said, but I watched what you were doing. And I saw you stay sober through terrible life's consequences and financial ruin and one thing and another and do okay with it and help each other along. And the more I watched, I started to listen a little bit at a time. And as I started to listen, you know, it began to apply to me. From listening, I started doing a little reading. And, you know, as I did that, I began to learn. And once I started to learn, then I started to have the ability to apply what you taught me in my own life. Along the way, you know, a remarkable transition occurred. And, you know, somewhere, and I don't know when or how, but you people executed the change in me from being a doctor who drank too much to an alcoholic who happens to take care of sick people for a living. We all do something for a living. My job is I take care of sick people. And this is my real job right here. The other stuff is just what we do to make money and get by. But this is our job. You know, this is how we save each other's lives. Life today is a whole lot different than what it was. I practice emergency medicine, and so on a very regular basis, I have a picture window on the disease of alcoholism, you know. This is not a pretty way to die, folks. But I'm convinced that if you had not rescued me, you know, I would have been the guy lying in the grass in the park, you know, with his liver turned to stone, and I've had the perfect justification. It ain't my fault. I love taking care of drunks today. You know, the stories are great. These guys come in and they say the kind of things I used to say. There I was, minding my own business. Had a couple of drinks, you know, not doing anybody any harm, or I was sitting at home, and the police kicked in my front door and drug my ass off to jail. Taking care of drunks provides me a tremendous spiritual barometer. Okay, if the medics bring in a guy that hasn't had a shower, you know, since the first of the year, and he's peed his pants, and you know, I had a stressful day, and I'm upset, and I think, why couldn't they find him on the lawn over there a couple hours from now after I've gone off duty? Then it's time to call my sponsor, go to a meeting, do that kind of stuff. If the same guy comes in, I'm able to take that unwashed hand and say, there, but by the grace of God, go I. I'm okay, you know, because that should have been me. And I try real hard not to take that for granted. One of the things that I learned from you folks is who the true healer really is. You know, I'm just there to help. And I do okay as a first assistant. And what a tremendous lightening of my load of responsibility that was, you know, to not have to be responsible for everybody's happiness and well-being. Today, I can go in and do my best and not have to control the outcome. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know about the biochemistry of ethanol metabolism from medical school. I know about the pathophysiology of alcohol ingestion, same place. But everything, I mean everything, I know about the disease of alcoholism I learned in these rooms. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people treating patients out there today that don't know shit about alcoholism. I used to be one of them. Along the way, I acquired a family in this program. I met a woman in my first couple of years of recovery, and I'm proud to say I was attracted to her program before I was attracted to the rest of her. Well, that's not entirely true. It may have been 50-50. But I eventually got up the nerve, risked being rejected, and asked her out to lunch, and in May we celebrated our 17th wedding anniversary. She brought with her into that relationship a little 5-year-old girl, and I had no idea how bad I needed to be a daddy. I learned how to do that in here, too. That little 5-year-old girl is now 23, and she can still manipulate me like a chiropractor. And she knows it, and I know it, and I'm real okay with that, you know? I'm a pretty good daddy today, and I learned how to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. Along the way, a number of things have happened. You know, in the last 20 years, I haven't again found it necessary to pee in the planter in the lobby of the Hyatt Regency. That's got to be good news for somebody. I haven't had to explain to the deputy sheriff that scratch on the bumper of my old truck is from just normal wear and tear, not from tearing open the fender of a car I was parked next to when I was too drunk to be driving out of the parking lot. I still owe that guy an amends, by the way, but he's a karate instructor, so I think I'll let him cool off just a little bit more. My wife and I have an orchard that we tend to when we have an opportunity, and that to me has become a real relaxing thing to do. You know, I take my cup of coffee out and walk through the trees in the early morning and talk to my higher power, and it's fun to watch, you know, that process occur. You know, we left last week. We had all these little baby plums and apricots and pears and apples. And it's just a miracle to watch that occur, you know. I'm looking forward to having diarrhea the entire month of August. We're going to have a great crop this year. And today I can appreciate those little things. I can go out there and you know, spray on some water and, you know, some nice toxic chemicals every now and then. And they grow great. And those are the kind of things that I enjoy today. I still don't have a Ferrari, okay. But I've got a New Holland tractor that's to die for. And I'm every bit as proud of it. You know, it stays in the garage. Our cars sit outside in the snow. And almost to the dollar, it was 1/20th the cost of the Ferrari. So I came out of that deal okay. AA is a big part of my life today. And I'm happy to report that two of the men that I sponsor are sitting in this room. You know, that's how we keep each other going. My own sponsor couldn't be here because of a family illness, but in following his guidance and direction, hello to everyone in Ontario from Dave C. In closing, I would like to make one pitch for these little guys right here. I don't know if you've been wearing those around town, but I'd encourage you to do so. You've earned them, okay? And there's certainly not enough information on there for anybody to steal your Social Security number or anything. The thing I try to remember is we wear a badge every day, regardless of what we got around our neck. We wear this badge of recovery. This is a program of attraction. That's what got me here, the attraction of watching it work for you people. When my wife and I were getting on the train over in Vancouver on Friday night, or I'm sorry, on Sunday, there was a guy there with a T-shirt I just had to go ask about, and I went across to the waiting area and got his attention. He turned around, and he had a little triangle in the circle earring on. And I thought, damn, I'll bet I know where he's going. And so we got on the 3-day train trip after we sat and talked there for several hours waiting for this train that was very late. And good old John Paul started to make connections here and there. And by the time we got off the train in Toronto, the Everyday A New Time Zone group had acquired 11 members and was having meetings at 11 o'clock in the morning, you know, all because he was wearing his badge. And that's what I think of when I think about, you know, emotional sobriety. Wear your badge well, and it isn't what you have on with it that's important. You know, God knows I tried. My approach to things when I got here was to look good from the outside and hope that it sunk to the middle. Okay. And what I learned was that was only one of many things I was doing backwards. What you taught me was you work on the inside and let it work its way to the surface. Okay. Show that to other people. You never know. You know, in the back of the room, there may be, you know, some overeducated, unteachable prick like I was that's watching everything you do. And that person may require seeing a big book on feet before he can ever make heads or tails of the one that's in print. This is a great fellowship. You know, please don't hesitate to pass it along. Wear your badge, and when you get up in the morning, put that badge on early. And try to wear it throughout the day, because I was watching it and I still am. And last, I'd like to thank each and every one of you for saving my life for another day. As I said, looking around here, I think AA is going to continue to survive for quite some time. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming clear to Toronto to make a 12-step call on me. Please let's thank our panel one more time.